WBAI New York at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Professor Linda McDonald Carter, Esquire, sitting in for Gloria J. Brown Marshall. She'll be back next Tuesday at 9 a.m. for Law of the Land. Once again, the Gothamist is reporting that more children were killed last year by vehicles in New York City than any year since the launch of the Street Safety Initiative Vision Zero, a new analysis found yesterday. Transportation Alternatives found that 16 children under 18 years old were killed in 2022 by drivers. Three of the victims were killed biking or walking from school. Please be careful and do slow down. WBAI New York, it's 10 a.m. and coming up next is Clearing the Fog.
This is Tony Roberts, and you're listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth since 1960.
If you knew what they were saying when they think you cannot hear, if you understood what they do, if for you it was so clear, if you knew they shut down the factory in an economic ruse, if you could kiss the cheek of the child in the sweatshop that made your shoes, every time we went to war to fight our evil foes, they told you we were really fighting for the good of CEOs. If you could feel the hunger of the many, see the riches of the few, if they told it like it is, what if you knew?
You're listening to Clearing the Fog, speaking truth to expose the forces of greed on Pacifica Radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. I'm Margaret Flowers. So this week I interviewed Helya Dutagi. She is an adjunct professor and doctoral candidate at Carleton University in Ottawa, Ontario, where she focuses on law and legal studies. She's also a co-chair of the International People's Tribunal on U.S. Imperialism, which is set to launch in New York City on January 28th at the People's Forum. You can attend in person or you can sign up to watch it online. It's from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m., as I said, January 28th. And the website to do that is sanctionstribunal.org. Sanctionstribunal.org. And this is an effort that has been going on for a few years. It's an international effort led by social movements and scholars and legal experts. And they're going to be exploring the different forms of sanctions and the impacts that they have on the people of the countries that they're imposed upon, the legality. And as Helya explains in the interview, this is part of holding nations accountable and building an international movement to do that. And this has a particular focus on the United States. Before we get to that interview, I'd like to talk about some things that are in the news. And I will start with a COVID-19 update. In the United States, there are now almost 104 million documented cases, although experts believe that this is an undercount of the actual number of cases. And some believe that as many as 200 million people in the U.S. have been infected. There are more than 1,128,000 deaths, and the number of deaths is starting to rise again, which is kind of expected after the bump in cases following the holidays. The Omicron subvariant XBB 1.5 continues to grow as a proportion of cases in the United States, now accounting for almost 50% of cases, up from 37% the week before. And this is significant because this new variant is better at evading the immune system. It's also better at causing infection. So it's more infectious than the previous variants. So continue to protect yourselves and those around you from COVID-19. Fortunately, the federal government has continued the public emergency measures for now. One thing that came out of the COVID-19 pandemic was an increase in what's called the zero fare movement. So the COVID-19 pandemic really exposed a lot of things about the nation, in particular health insecurity and economic insecurity, and the importance in public transportation in helping people to move about as they need to, get to work, get to places where they can purchase the things that they need. And so a number of cities have been experimenting with zero fare for public transportation. Kansas City was one of the first cities in the U.S. to invest in this, but also Boston, San Francisco, and Denver. And now Washington, D.C. looks like it may become the next city to have free transit for all D.C. residents. The Bureau of Labor Statistics released its annual union membership report on January 19th. And what they found is that for wage and salary workers, the proportion of workers that are in a union has fallen. This is either in a union or represented by a union. And it was 10.3% in 2021, down to 10.1% in 2022. This is the lowest level since they began documenting union membership in 1983, when it was at 20.1%. There are significant barriers in the United States to be unionized, and there's an estimate that about 60 million workers would join unions if they were able to, but these legal barriers are in their way. And looking at the numbers, there is actually an increase in the total number of unionized workers in the United States by 200,000. But the growth in jobs that were non-unionized outpaced the growth in jobs that have unions. And so that's why overall the percentage fell. And in the U.S., black workers are more likely to be in a job that's unionized than white workers, 11.6% to 10% for white workers. But the wave in the United States to unionize continues to grow. Good news was announced last week. Amazon Labor Union at Staten Island, which voted 9 months ago in April to form a union, then had to endure a number of legal challenges by Amazon to their formation of a union. And fortunately, the National Labor Relations Board recently ruled that all of those challenges were unsubstantiated and went ahead and recognized the Amazon Labor Union in Staten Island. So that's good news. And then also Pete's Coffee workers, following in the footsteps of the Starbucks workers union, formed their first union in Davis, California on Friday, the Pete's Workers Union, part of SEIU, Service Employee International Union, and they intend to continue organizing more Pete's Coffee stores across the nation. So these efforts by small groups to continue to unionize is significant and hopefully will grow in 2023. Now in France, workers, they're just amazing at defending their rights. And this past week, on January 19th, there was a national strike. It's estimated more than 2 million people took part in that across the nation. There were 200 demonstrations, 400,000 people came out in Paris, and they are protesting a change in their pension system, trying to raise the age for retirement from 62 to 64. 80% of the public opposes raising the retirement age. And so they held this national strike. 40% of teachers participated, meaning that a lot of schools had to close down. Transport workers participated, meaning that public transportation was not functioning. And they have vowed to have a national strike again on January 31st. This campaign is ongoing. In Peru, protests continue there following the coup against the president, Pedro Castillo. And in Lima, tens of thousands of people traveled to the city to participate in a national strike, also on January 19th. People came from throughout the country to Lima. Some of them stayed at the National University of San Marcos, which was providing accommodations for them. And they held a successful day of protesting in the city, although they faced continue to face repression by the police. So far, 54 protesters have been killed by the state in these protests, which began after the December 7th coup. And then on Saturday, the national police raided the university, came in with helicopters and equipment, and arrested a number of the organizers of the protests, and then also confiscated a lot of their belongings and supplies. So the political repression continues in Peru, but the people are not giving up. They're continuing to demand that the acting president, Dina Boluarte, resign. And they're also demanding a constituent assembly to develop a new constitution. The current constitution came out of the Fujimori dictatorship. It was created in 1993. Over the weekend and past week, solidarity rallies have happened across the country after police in Atlanta, Georgia, raided the Wilani Forest, where the city is trying to build a huge police training facility. Activists call it Cop City. On the morning of January 18th, police came in with guns to raid the camp that has been there in the forest to protect it from being torn down. And they started to remove protesters' tents and belongings from the forest. And in that, they murdered one of the activists, Manuel Turan, known as Tortuito, the little tortoise. And he was 26 years old. After that, protests broke out, particularly, you know, outrage over the murder of Manuel Turan, because activists in the forest have asked police not to come into the forest with guns, as they have been doing, but also because the police are trying to portray this as a self-defense, claiming that Turan fired at them. There's no evidence to support this, and people with the Stop Cop City movement say this is false. There were rallies and protests throughout the country over the weekend, and it continued to happen, to banner drops and all types of actions. People are targeting some of the corporations that are funding the Cop City project. Wells Fargo Bank is one. Home Depot is another. There was a large protest over the weekend in Atlanta, and police arrested in a violent way some of the protesters who were taking part in that, and some of them are now facing felonies in that. The Atlanta Solidarity Fund is building a legal team to investigate the death of Manuel Turan. They're calling for an independent investigation. Right now, it's the Georgia Bureau of Investigation that's conducting that, but activists are not confident that that will be an actual independent investigation of what happened. In Canada, some good news, a class action lawsuit over the destruction of languages and culture, Indigenous languages and culture, because of the long history of residential schools, was finally settled. 325 First Nations participated in that class action lawsuit, and the settlement was for $2.8 billion that will be placed in a trust that's run independently of the government. Those funds will be used for the revival, protection, promotion, and wellness of Indigenous languages and cultures. So various First Nations may use the funds to develop cultural centers, to hire language teachers, and things of that nature. This does not preclude individuals from going on and pursuing legal action over the injuries and death that people suffered in those residential schools. But this is a first step in recognizing the destructive impact of those schools on the culture, Indigenous culture. Also, last week, Palestine Action in the United Kingdom took another strong action to shut down Israelis' weapons makers. This time it was Palestine Action Scotland in their second big action, this one in Edinburgh, focused on the Leonardo Arms Factory. The activists took over the building, occupied it, and began to actually dismantle the machinery in the building. This is an Italian company. It's one of the world's largest arms companies. and they have close ties with the state of Israel. In fact, they had a merger with an Israeli company. They provide also weapons to the Israeli occupying forces. So this is a continuation of Palestine Action's excellent campaign to shut down these weapons makers that are being used. Their weapons are being used to murder and really conduct a genocide against the Palestinian people in occupied Palestine. Last Thursday, people with the Beyond Extreme Energy Coalition took action in Washington, D.C. at the monthly meeting at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. One of their focuses was stopping the Mountain Valley Pipeline. They were able to get into the meeting and cause a disruption there. This is a campaign that's been going on for quite a long time now, to demand that the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission become the Federal Renewable Energy Commission. They are particularly focused on Joe Manchin, who is the current chair of the Senate Energy Committee. Manchin from West Virginia has ties to the fossil fuel industry and since taking that position has been pressuring the FERC to streamline permits for fossil fuel projects, even though we are facing a climate crisis and we need to stop investing in fossil fuel infrastructure. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission is an interesting body because, you know, it sounds like a federal agency, but in fact, it is not federally funded. The FERC is funded through its oil and gas permits. So they need to be granting permits for oil and gas projects in order to exist as an agency. So we need to dismantle the FERC and create a FREC that actually puts in place a plan to move off of fossil fuels quickly and to renewable energy. And then over the weekend was an action, a national day of action to honor Joy Braun. Joy was a member of the Cheyenne River Sioux. This action happened on her birthday. She died last November at the age of 53. But she was a strong anti-pipeline proponent. She took place starting in 2010 in actions to stop the Keystone XL pipeline. And then she was one of the first people to set up the Sacred Stone Camp in North Dakota against the Dakota Access Pipeline. She had the first structure in what later became the Sacred Stone Camp. And of course, that grew. It went on for many months. It started in April, I think it was 2015, and went on into the winter of that following winter. So activists had actions across the country in memory of Joy Braun, and they are calling on President Biden to declare a climate emergency. And then finally, on Friday, last Friday, the third Belmarsh Tribunal took place at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. This is an effort that's being spearheaded by Progressive International. The focus of this Belmarsh Tribunal is to expose and scrutinize U.S. war crimes and also to advocate for the release of Julian Assange. There's a tremendous lineup of people that participated in that tribunal. John Shipton, who is Julian Assange's father, was there, as well as Assange's wife, who's a lawyer, Stella Assange. Jeremy Corbyn came from the United Kingdom. Stephen Donziger, the human rights lawyer, who was incarcerated after successfully suing Chevron for its pollution in Ecuador in the Amazon. Daniel Ellsberg, who was similarly, he actually leaked materials that were published and faced trial for that. And, you know, Assange was a publisher. Assange is more like the New York Times than a leaker. But Ellsberg was there saying, look, if you're going to prosecute Julian Assange, you should prosecute me as well. Stefania Morizzi, a journalist who's written an excellent book about Julian Assange. And then Noam Chomsky was there, Kevin Gashtola of The Dissenter, Chip Gibbons of Defending Rights and Dissent all spoke at that tribunal. I highly recommend that, and that is something that you can find, watch the whole tribunal online on Consortium News. So check that out. The movement to free Julian Assange continues to grow. There are organizations around the world that hold regular actions at the British embassies and media outlets, and you know, the calls to free Assange are growing. This is something that President Biden could do. I mean, let's remember that under the Obama-Biden administration, they decided not to pursue prosecution of Julian Assange, recognizing the impact that it would have on journalists around the world and their willingness and ability to publish information that is leaked to them. And so they didn't pursue that, but then the Trump administration did take up the prosecution of Assange. He's not been convicted of any crimes, nor did he commit a crime, but he's been held now in prison for years and is facing extradition to the United States and a possible imprisonment sentence of 175 years. There's no reason to believe that Assange would have a fair trial if he came to the United States, and many people have pointed that out. There are a lot of reasons why he should not be extradited. His health is one of them. Also, the political nature of the case, which is supposed to disqualify extradition to another country. But this continues to go on. He continues to be in prison. His health is suffering as a result of that. He should be with his wife and his two young children. So we here in the United States have a particular role to play in this, in demanding that the Biden administration's Department of Justice drop the charges now against Julian Assange and that he be freed and allowed to go home. In fact, there have been protests. The D.C. Assange group has been holding rallies in front of Merrick Garland's house, making that demand. So that's all I have for the news. I'm going to take a short musical break, and then I'll come back with the interview with Helia Dutagy about the International People's Tribunal on U.S. imperialism. Expose the forces of greed on listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. I'm Margaret Flowers. And now I turn to my guest, Helia Dutagy. She is the adjunct professor and a doctoral candidate in law and legal studies at Carleton University. Her research explores the intersections of sanctions regimes, imperialism, and international law. She's the co-chair of the International People's Tribunal on U.S. imperialism and an anti-imperialist organizer in the student movement. Thank you for taking time to join me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So today I'd like to talk with you about the International People's Tribunal on U.S. imperialism, which is set to have its official launch at the end of this month. But before we get into that, can you please explain to the listeners a little bit about how you became interested in being an activist and a student on this issue?
Absolutely. So, well before we started talking or thinking about the tribunal, I joined a collective called CASI, the Committee of Anti-Imperialists in Solidarity with Iran, which was formed to really put out a concentrated effort to challenge U.S. imperialism on Iran. As as folks, as the part of the group, all of them were located in the United States and Canada, we considered ourselves as part of the broader anti-imperialist and anti-war movement throughout the world. And one of the founding principles of CASI was to reject all forms of imperialist interventions in Iran by the U.S. and other functionaries of imperialism who executed the imperialist agenda on Iran and more broadly in the region at the expense of the people. So this included and includes overt and covert interventions, such as the establishment of U.S. military bases surrounding Iran, the continued threat of war, assassinations, sanctions, embargoes, covert interventions in the form of undercover agents and provocateurs, targeted assassinations of Iranian leaders, of Iranian scientists, of Iranian generals, sabotage of the domestic infrastructure of Iran and providing economic and military support to pro-imperialist forces within Iran. So as part of our work, and especially I want to highlight this being located within the heart of U.S. imperialism, we understood our job to oppose the imperial violence of this country so that the people of the world may build their own societies free from the terror of imperial violence. And this was how we initially began to think about some of the ways in which we can build this movement towards realizing our goals and principles. And that's how we initially came about the tribunal idea.
Can you explain to the listeners about the tribunal? What exactly is it, and what other organizations are part of organizing it?
Before I can answer that, let me tell you why exactly we chose People's Tribunal as the framework of our organizing, because I think, we gave a lot of thought into it and it was very important. So as organizers that have chosen People's Tribunal, we did so because it is a model that has long roots in anti-imperialist and anti-capitalist organizing. People's tribunals capture the self-determination and internationalism that was expressed through 20th century anti-colonial struggles. And it was institutionalized actually in the 1966 Tricontinental Conference in Cuba. They bring together movement lawyers and organizers from around the world and are designed by and they're accountable to the social movements and communities in which they're rooted. We operate outside of the logics and institutions of capitalist and imperialist law. And People's Tribunal make decisions because of this and their structure that may not be binding legally, and they may not have the force of law, but their achievement in a political and discursive register really inspire and provide the tools necessary for present and future organizing on a matter. So in a sense, People's Tribunal allow the oppressed to judge the powerful, and they define the content as well as the scope of the procedures which reverse the norm of the powerful creating and implementing the law. And that's what's really powerful about this. There is a long tradition of radical organizing using the law to put capitalism and imperialism on trial. And with this tribunal specifically, we hope to draw from and contribute to this radical tradition of using international law against the very hierarchies and systems of oppressions that it was designed to uphold. So to explain a little further about how the tribunal works, what it entails, as I mentioned, Iran has been one of the main targets of U.S. imperialism in the form of sanctions for decades now, since 1950s. And that's a really historical misconception that people believe or think that sanctions on Iran came about after the Islamic Revolution in 79. It's a historical misconception because the nationalization of oil by Mohammad Mossadegh, who was later overthrown in a coup orchestrated by CIA, was actually the initial point of sanctions, because immediately after oil was nationalized and Iran refused to provide access to its resources to these imperialist powers, they place a comprehensive embargo against Iranian oil. So it's more about sovereignty rather than anything else, really, when it comes to sanctions. And I can get into more details later. But We also knew that Iran was not the only country subject to this violence, to U.S. imperialism, and Iranians were not the only people suffering under these measures. So in varying degrees, we knew that countries such as Cuba, Venezuela, Iraq, Zimbabwe, Lebanon, and others were targeted by the same measures. So we thought that it would be very important to build a truly international movement that brings together those at the receiving end of imperialism in the form of sanctions to collectively challenge sanctions in all its shape or forms, including in their targeted and smart forms, which seems to be more popular these days. And really enforce that these measures are enforced and designed by U.S. Government and its economic and political apparatus, but also justified by its intellectual arm, whether that is through universities and by scholars or funded think tanks or NGOs, industrial complex and corporate media. They all play a huge role in justifying and sustaining these measures. So we had to tackle that. We had to provide an alternative narrative as to what these are. It was necessary for us to center the experiences of those people living under sanctions. I'm not trying to reproduce this liberal chatter of be their voice kind of thing, but it was more of a way to ensure that we investigate sanctions not from the perspective of those who design and enforce them, but from the perspective who are most impacted by them, namely by the people of the global south. So it's been over 2 years in the making as a legal and political response to the proliferation of sanctions regimes against the global south by US, EU, and also the Security Council since the end of Cold War. So the tribunal was conceived with a coalition of over 30 organizations internationally. And it was also out of an urge, as I said, to provide a highly intellectual analysis of sanctions to help expose the underlying imperialist and capitalist constructions of sanctions regime that challenge their conceptions as peaceful alternatives to war.
Right. And of course, that's part of the narrative. People in the U.S. are not really informed about what the United States is doing around the world with this, these economic measures. But that is one way that it's been kind of sold to the public, is that, oh, this is so much more humane than actually invading, militarily these countries.
That's how they've been sustained, precisely.
Right. So talk a little bit about the tribunal. How is it actually going to function? Who's going to testify?
Mm-hmm. So we will use the tribunal as a place to hold hearings on the impact of sanctions on 16 countries in Latin America, Africa, and Asia, which are the main targets of U.S. sanctions. The opening session of the tribunal, as you mentioned earlier, is coming up. We're very excited about it, and it's coming up in January 28th, taking place in New York City at People's Forum. It will be a hybrid event, so if folks are available and can come in person, that they are more than welcome to do so. It's a public event, and otherwise they can register to attend online. And the closing session will be held in July 2023 in Venezuela. Both of these events are going to be in person. However, all the hearings of the tribunal over the 6 months, starting February and ending in July, will be held online, and people can register to attend those hearings as well. The nations represented in the tribunal include Cuba, Ethiopia, Eritrea, Haiti, Iran, Iraq, Lebanon, Libya, Palestine, Nicaragua, North Korea, Sudan, Syria, Venezuela, Yemen, and Zimbabwe. It's 16 states. And as for the themes of the tribunal, we know sanctions impact every aspect of life in these countries. But we have selected 15 themes to cover in the tribunal, although neither the list of the countries that we have chosen nor the themes that we have that I'm indicating are the exhaustive list of the countries being sanctioned by the U.S. or the impacts, but we had to make decisions according to our capacity. So some of the themes include public health, financial system, refugee and migration, experts in tourism, education, technology development, infrastructure, agriculture, civil society, development, which is a huge, huge impact of sanctions, women empowerment, macroeconomics, manufacturing and industry, environmental impacts of sanctions, and welfare and employment. And during these country hearings, expert witnesses, from scholars to lawyers to those who have worked one way or another on sanctions, will be testifying as expert witnesses. We have victims, direct individuals who have directly been impacted by sanctions, and legal experts as well will present evidence against the U.S. We have an impressive list of jurors that folks are welcome to check from our website, sanctionstribunal.org, who will help us take the next steps after tribunal, which I'm happy to talk about later.
Yeah, if you would, go ahead and talk about kind of the, I know there's three main goals for the tribunal and what will come out of it.
Absolutely. So we are using the tribunal as an organizing and political education and legal tool. So organizing is one part, organizing and political education is one part, and legal tour is another. Our legal objective is to work with both the respected jurors of the tribunal as well as our legal team to identify legal causes of action to deploy in international and U.S. courts and or U.S. courts. We're gonna decide that based on our findings. And our political objective involves laying the groundwork for an international campaign against economic coercive measures, building international consensus around the illegality of sanctions, and using grassroots activism such as protests, direct actions, to support the work of the tribunal. Another primary goal is to use the tribunal and its outcome as an educational for everyone who's interested in joining the movement to charge and challenge imperialism. Researchers and scholars and activists will have access to the testimonies, which will serve as an invaluable primary source for those interested in studying sanctions and researching sanctions. We will also be publishing the findings and our analysis of the tribunal with a short report immediately after, but we will also be working on a book project that includes all the findings of the tribunal, and this will take place probably later after we conclude the tribunal.
Right, and as you said, this type of information gathering is really critical because it can actually be used later on if you go ahead and pursue, or there are legal efforts that are pursued, then this can be used as evidence in those types of endeavors. Is that correct?
That is correct. And precisely, we think it's really valuable because a lot of even critical scholarship on sanctions in the literature, if you look at it, really stem from scholars that are either situated in Western institutions, or they themselves are like think tanks or policymakers that have designed these measures and then are looking back critically, reflecting on it to see how they can improve it, whether that's making it have consideration for humanitarian concern, so-called making it targeted, or trying to make it more efficient to achieve its goals. So there is a real absence in the experiences and voices of those who are directly living under these conditions that could be really invaluable for research and investigation.
And how do you see this moment as an important time for this type of international organizing and effort? What's been so interesting to me over the last few years is as the power of the United States is declining, it feels like more countries are having the courage to stand up to the United States. I think Iran is an excellent example when Iran sent tankers, this was during the Trump administration, to Venezuela to provide materials that were needed for the oil refinery. And also, you know, Iran sent, you know, all kinds of other medical and food aid to Venezuela. But the tankers in particular, because the United States Navy was in the waters around Venezuela, this was a huge, you know, courageous act to challenge the blockade of Venezuela. Do you feel like this is an opportune time for this type of movement?
Absolutely. Look, seeing the emergence of multilateralism and seeing nation states taking active and effective measures to challenge and move away from U.S. hegemony in international economic governance to ensure their development, to ensure their rights of sovereignty, is rather a natural response to years of U.S. domination and exploitation of their lands and resources and labor. That's what we're trying. Exactly, the example you provided is a really good one to ensure how they're trying different ways of doing this, of achieving this, whether that's through a new bloc at the UN or reviving the new international economic order or bilateral and multilateral agreements like China's Belt Road Initiative, or as you said, Iran and Venezuela publicly violating U.S. sanctions, right? Or countries taking effective steps to de-dollarize their trade and economies, and much more that is rapidly happening over the past few years, and it's only increasing. It allows us to witness the decay of U.S. imperialism and sanctions backfiring not only on U.S. but also on U.S. and European population. Mm-hmm. But something I want to highlight here is that we're seeing sanctions backfire. And there are two main reasons for that. Number one is really the how sanctions are targeting the global majority of people. So it allows the countries and the people to rise up collectively against them. But number two, the targeted states are starting to realize that they should no longer only try to lift sanctions, whether that's through negotiations or what have you, but rather to neutralize them. Because we know that appealing to the moral sense of the oppressor is never going to get us free, as Asata Shakur told us. So they're taking effective measures to bust sanctions and neutralize them without necessarily having to convince the U.S. or other imposing bodies of sanctions to lift them or give them free passes or OFAC giving them licenses for this or that trade. And I think that's really powerful in this moment.
Yeah, and necessary. As we see, the United States, you know, continues to use this despite the fact that it imposes such, you know, human rights abuses around the world and is not achieving, as you said, it's backfiring against the U.S., but the U.S. is not going to change course unless mm-hmm. it's actually forced to. Now, you mentioned the United Nations. A few years ago, there was a launch of a new coalition, Friends in Defense of the United Nations Charter, and most, if not all, of the nations are nations that are being targeted by the United States. How do you see that body is and how does that, do you think, will that relate to this effort to build a people's movement?
It's important to see different ways of states, but also non-states, coming together to challenge the unilateralism of the United States. But I see that as just one example among many that I just mentioned. And this tribunal right now is really organized by the people for the people, whether or not we will be working with member states to escalate our efforts after the conclusion of the tribunal, whether that is through taking the case to international tribunals that have only jurisdiction over a state, so we will have to work with the state members, or to take it to U.S. courts or not, is something yet to be determined. But right now, I see that as part of a broader challenge to U.S. imperialism and unilateralism.
The People's Tribunal on U.S. Imperialism distinguishes sanctions, blockades, and coercive economic measures. Could you explain for the listeners a little bit about the differences between these three mechanisms?
Mm-hmm. So, well, there are different ways to define these terms depending on the context. And sometimes in the literature, they're used interchangeably. But for our purposes, we refer to sanctions as restricting measures that laid out in piece of legislations or executive order or UN resolutions that can be applied both broadly or specifically on industries and countries, and also selectively on individuals. But their main difference with embargoes as we use them. We refer to embargoes, on the other hand, to refer to a much broader and more comprehensive prohibition of trade with target countries or imports from or exports to the target country. Cuba is a good example of this. It's a comprehensive embargo against this country. So is Gaza. Gaza blockade by the Zionist entity is also another example. And when we refer to unilateral coercive measures, we borrow it from the UN language because in UN documents, they rarely refer to these measures as sanctions or embargoes, but they use coercive economic measures. And we use this rather as an umbrella term to generally address the overarching system of rules and obligations and behaviors that are designed to interfere with normal activities, that is restricting or prohibiting something that is usually permissible. And it could be economic, but it could also be political and personal rather. So in the form of restricting trade, or certain commodities, that is an economic example. But when it comes to political sanctions or political coercive measures, we've seen closure of embassies or reducing diplomatic relations, or on a personal level or individual level, we've seen imposing travel bans on individuals, for instance, or state leaders. And they could also be unilaterally imposed by one country, namely the U.S., or multilateral, which is a group of states like the EU and the U.S. coming together, a Security Council under Chapter 7, ensuring that they're applied by all member states. We chose these three to really just cover all the bases and be able to address different forms of sanctions as they come.
So, for example, the United States blocking the travel of political leaders or the representatives to the United Nations meetings in New York, or the seizure of the Venezuelan embassy in Washington, D.C. when the U.S. refuses to recognize the elected government of Venezuela. Do you see those then as unilateral coercive measures?
There are certainly coercive measures for sure, and very good examples of that. And it shows you how, when it comes to not allowing diplomats to travel to UN, how international law could really be could have limited capacity and power to tackle U.S. unilateralism as well.
Mm-hmm. So, can you talk a little bit about international law? How do the U.S.'s actions, are they legal under international law, illegal? Can you discuss that?
For sure. Let me discuss how the use of sanctions by the U.S. and how they serve U.S. political agenda and imperialism, and then how they interact with international law. So sanctions are designed and used by the U.S. and its allies, such as Canada, I'm calling from Ottawa today, and European countries, to maintain the existing hierarchical world order, and that is the global capitalist imperialist order. To achieve this goal, to maintain the existing order, sanctions aim to prevent and destroy any political formation, any national liberation movement carrying out pro-resistance political agenda. And if there is a state power to turn into it as an example, to punish that state. Look at Iran after revolution, look at Cuba, look at Venezuela, right? Carrying out their own sovereignty and political and economic agenda is going to be prevented or damaged by U.S. sanctions. And if you break from the U.S. capitalist geopolitical imperative, we will make sure that you don't succeed, or we will make sure that we inflict significant violence and harm upon you. So from this perspective, as the tribunal, we understand sanctions as inherently violent measures that are designed to maintain the hierarchy and inequality in international economic and political system. First and foremost, we think that sanctions are designed to continue the theft of wealth from the global south. Let me give you an example here. According to the latest report of the Security Council on UCM, unilateral coercive measures, for instance, Iran's frozen assets in foreign accounts have estimated at 100 to 100 20 billion US dollars. And this is only in frozen assets. And it does not even take into account the trade restrictions or the exclusion from labor market and so on and so forth. So it's ineffective, and it's only Iran. There are so many other countries that are under this, under similar conditions. It's an effective theft of wealth from these countries in different forms. And sanctions are designed to also preserve the racial hierarchy in international system. We think it's not accidental that almost all target states of sanctions are in the global south. It's not accidental. It's part of the broader north-south division or core periphery division of the world that further capitalist agendas. So such measures are structurally incapable of reform. And we don't believe that so-called smart sanctions or individual sanctions, as they really try to come up with it, even adopted by some left and so-called progressives in Western countries, they don't work. This is inherently violent imperial measures, and they can't incorporate humanitarian concerns. So they're deployed as these imperial tools of policing, if you will, by the U.S. to not only punish those who defy its domination, but also to reproduce a specific order, and that is the capitalist imperialist order. So from this perspective, as I also mentioned earlier, we reject the understanding of sanctions as peaceful, nonviolent measures that operate as alternative to war and armed conflict, because we know that sanctions are specifically designed to starve nations, to demolish their growth and productive capacity, to limit their access to vital medicine. And as we saw happen over the pandemic in so many countries, including Iran, including Venezuela, Iraq, and elsewhere, and limit their access to vital medicine, and also severely harm their industrial development that is necessary not only for survival, but also for development and growth. And in that sense, sanctions are imperial mechanisms that aim to de-develop and underdevelop nations. Which brings me to my next point here. And that is, while sanctions are often viewed as war, we go even further to argue that we need to situate sanctions not only in the constructed binary of war and peace, because war and peace are not neutrally constructed. We have been made to believe that peace looks like the absence of armed conflict. But if we take a deeper look, we see that nothing about the conditions we live in, including the worsening condition of unhoused population here and abroad, or the assassinations, or the proxy wars, or the dirty wars. Nothing about any of this is peaceful conditions, but we're made to believe that. And it is within this category that sanctions are also defined as peaceful alternatives to war, right? So we need to challenge that. And we need to situate sanctions within the broader economic context of capitalism and capitalist exploitation of the global south in which sanctions operate. They are a legal tool that, so law is really plays a key role in the enforcement of sanctions and the underdevelopment of often formerly colonized nations in Africa and Asia and Latin America, which is again not an accident that many of the sanctioned countries currently were formerly colonized before. And in this way, we believe that sanctions share some of the key aspects of European colonialism. Turning back to international law, we've seen the devastating humanitarian disaster that were brought by the Security Council sanctions regimes against Iraq during 1990s. We see that and we question, okay, how did under international law this was facilitated and this was maintained? And were there any accountability for 500,000 Iraqi children that were killed because of this? So I think one way to make sense of this, I personally consider myself as part of the TWEL movement, that is the third world approaches to international law. It's in a scholarly agenda of international law that finds colonialism and imperialism at the heart of the construction of international law. Anthony Yangi or B.S. Chimney are a couple of prominent scholars in this field. And it was, we believe that it was through the development of international law that the relationship between the West and the third world, so-called third world, was slowly replaced from one of colonizers and colonized to one of the developed and underdeveloped or developing, so-called. This new relationship was characterized by a humanitarian urge to uplift the so-called backward people and a belief in the capacity of Western science and technology to accomplish that task. So this colonial logic is actually very present in sanctions. The U.S. and Security Council wanted to, or sanctions regime in general imposed by all these parties, they want to make sure that states behave in a right way and states change course in their activities, right? It's about disciplining and it's about policing and it's about make sure they behave in the order that the U.S. wants to. And so coming to it from this perspective, it's really hard to believe in the emancipatory potentials of international law when it comes to sanctions. However, we do not reject that. We think it should be a tool in the toolbox. Law in general should be a tool in the toolbox that we use to challenge sanctions. Having said all this, even by the metrics of international law today, UN Special Rapporteur, the current UN Special Rapporteur on sanctions, Elena Dohan, and also the previous mandate holder, have found that U.S. sanctions are in clear violation of the most fundamental human rights of peoples, including the right to life, including the right to development, and others. And not only individuals, but also the states. They violate the principles of international law, such as the interference in domestic affairs of sovereign states, again, their right to development, and so on and so forth. So whether or not this violation of international law that has been acknowledged by its own UN's own special rapporteurs is enough to bring U.S. To account for these violations in international judicial system, that's a different question.
Right. I mean, I believe there was a case a number of years ago that Iran actually won against the United States over sanctions, but I don't think the U.S. ever took action on that. And I know that Venezuela, I think, currently has a case before the International Criminal Court arguing that the United States' coercive measures against Venezuela are a form of collective punishment that violates international law.
Mm-hmm. Those are good examples of taking legal action, which usually ends up not having enforcement mechanisms when the decisions are found. Yeah,
right, right. And of course, the International Court of Justice of the United Nations has no enforcement mechanisms. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, so these institutions, as you point out, they're an important tool, but they're not sufficient, to achieve the goals that we need to mm-hmm. achieve. So how can people who are listening learn more about the People's Tribunal, get involved, and then use the information that comes from that to further this movement?
So again, I want to repeat that we are launching the tribunal in a week, in January 28th. So if you are in New York City, you can attend in person at People's Forum. Otherwise, you can register to watch online. Please spread the word, news, and urge attendance for every hearing. That's a great way to support us. This is a grassroots project by the people and for the people. So also please consider donating. Every dollar counts. You can find all the information about the tribunal on our website, sanctionstribunal.org. So use the tribunal and its findings towards building and advancing educational and political campaigns on sanctions. And by joining the movement, you can support countries in the global South to continue build their own societies free from the terror of imperialist violence of US.
Right. Yeah. And as you said early on with the 15 different themes that are being covered by the tribunal, and you said that was not exhaustive. This is something that impacts every facet of people's lives. So no matter what issue you're organizing around, this is an important issue to educate yourself and others on and use these materials in your community to raise the awareness of what the United States is doing and the harms that it's causing. Elia, thank you so much for the very important work that you are doing and for taking time out of your busy schedule to speak with me today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me, Margaret.
Well, that's all for today. You've been listening to Clearing the Fog, Speaking Truth to Expose the Forces of Greed on Pacifica Radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. Pacifica Radio is listener-sponsored. If you like what you heard today, consider becoming a Clearing the Fog buddy by making a monthly donation to WBAI.org.
I'm Margaret Flowers. My guest today was Helia Dutagy of the International People's Tribunal on U.S. Imperialism. Again, that will be launched on January 28th at the People's Forum in New York City. You can attend in person from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m., or you can register to watch it online.